This is the 12 Songs of Christmas. I'm Alex Rawls, and today we're looking at another side of Christmas with Imogen Clark. Clark is from Australia, where the holiday iconography is very different. Since Australia is in the Southern Hemisphere, Christmas falls in the hot months, which means sleigh ride, let it snow, winter wonderland, and countless other songs in our Christmas canon mean nothing to them. One of my favorite songs along those lines comes from the Brazilian artist Curuman, who recorded In the Hot Sun of a Christmas Day in 2008. Here's a taste, and you can hear the different feel the warm weather vibe can lead to. We'll get to singer Imogen Clark in a moment, but let's do some housekeeping first. We're fortunate here in New Orleans to have a radio station as supportive of local music as WWOZ. And on Tuesday night, disc jockey David Koonian had me on to play and talk about Christmas music for a couple of hours. It was a lot of fun, and if you want to hear it, it will be online for 2 weeks in their archives. I'll put a link to the show in the show notes. Since part of the fun of 12 Songs is sharing Christmas music with people, I try to do what I can to get non-canonical Christmas music to you to make your holidays a little bit brighter. With that in mind, I have a 12 Songs of Christmas playlist up at Spotify and Apple Music. It's best heard on shuffle since it was more important to me to give you enough songs to create your own mini radio station than to try to program 4 or 5 hours of Christmas music. I'll put a link to both these playlists in the show notes, but you can also find them by searching for 12 Songs of Christmas Christmas or Alex Rawls on the streaming platform you use. Finally, I still have this year's free Christmas mix available to anyone who writes me at alex@myspiltmilk.com and asks for it. I do sequence it more deliberately, and it has songs that aren't available on the streaming services, including some Japanese songs that I learned about from Scott Leopold's Holly Jolly Xmasu podcast. Many of you have already reached out, and it's great to know that 12 Songs reaches people because so many people I run into think a podcast about Christmas music is a very nutty idea. All right, now to Imogen Clark. She has been working on music since she was a young teenager, and she first released music in 2020, unfortunately into the teeth of the pandemic. Her official biography on her website presents her as an indie rock person, and she mentions influences like Haim, Maggie Rogers, and Taylor Swift. Those, combined with the time she spent in Nashville, means that if you're like me, you'll hear a lot of contemporary country in her sound as well. When Clark agreed to do this interview, I hoped that she had some other interviews lined up because at the time we talked, it was 3:30 in the morning in Australia. She didn't, so Imogen gets credit with me for being the subject who went the longest way to help make an interview happen. Imogen got up early so that we could make this work, and I appreciate that very much. Let's start with a song from her 2020 EP, The Making of Me. This is My Own Worst Enemy, and we'll be back on the other side to talk about her Christmas music and Christmas in Australia. This is Imogen Clark on the 12 Songs of Christmas. Rearranging took some time. The self-fulfilling prophecy was recognized. Lost my patience, lost my pride. Never thought we'd see it to the other side. I've been reminiscing about the things you said. You've been talking. It's what we have to do as Australian artists. We live in a very far away, ridiculous place. So it's you know, it's the cross we must bear. So
I've got a coffee. I'm sitting on the floor in front of the window. I'm fine.
Excellent. All right, then. Let's start in a really basic place. Short version. What's your story?
So I love that question. So nice and broad. So I grew up in a small town in the western suburbs of Sydney, so about an hour and a half out of the city near a big area called the Blue Mountains. And I came from a musical family. My dad played music all of my life, so that's how I naturally picked up instruments, because he sort of wasn't precious about letting me play them. And I found my love of songwriting at maybe 12 or 13 years old, and I've been a professional musician ever since then, which is sounds funny to say, imagining a 12-year-old sort of playing gigs in pubs and stuff. So, I've released a few albums and EPs and toured around the world, and it's been an incredible journey up till now, and no signs of slowing yet for me.
Yeah, good for you. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
I was thinking about having adventures that earlier, I guess in October, you released a song, If I Want In, and you recorded it at Abbey Road.
Yes.
Okay, that's awesome. Tell me about that experience.
Yeah, sure. It's still such a funny thing to even hear someone say. It feels very surreal to me, even having lived it a few months back. So that was back in July, and what we decided to do was, you know, the last few years have obviously been so hard for everybody and difficult in the music industry. And we made music remotely, which wasn't ideal, but we were doing the best we could in a difficult situation. And so when it came time to make a new record for me, it was like, what can we do that is the opposite of what we've had to do for the last few years? So instead, let's go to the most iconic music studios in the world. We recorded in Nashville and LA and obviously London, which brought us to Abbey Road. And that was honestly one of the most magical experiences of my life. You walk in there and it's just so the hallowed halls with all the history on the walls and these beautiful sort of photos of the Beatles and Pink Floyd and all these people that have sort of graced these studios, and that they have not only state-of-the-art equipment but just the most sort of the feeling of a long legacy of iconic music. So to be a small part of that felt very special to me.
What surprised you about the actual space?
You know, I think what surprised me the most was that it was just like any other normal studio. I think that sounds funny, but like you go into a place like that that you've read about and heard about for so many years and seen in documentaries, and you kind of expect it to be almost something that's been sort of kept alive for like tourism purposes and not a real studio. But you go in there and it's not, they've never had it as a tourist destination on the inside. They've always kept it as a fully functioning studio, and they never want it to just be a tourist attraction that doesn't function. And so it's really special. You go in there and it's just like it's just kind of like any other studio. After a while, you sort of forget that you're in Abbey Road and you're like, oh, that's right. Every sort of 10 or 15 minutes I go, oh, we're not just in any studio. We're in the studio.
See, now I have to say, as a non-musician, I always wonder how much the studio really matters. Is it the space or is it the people who are there working it? What was your experience?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I reckon it's a bit of everything, because, you know, you can have a wonderful space, but then if you don't have really experienced and talented engineers and producers and if you don't have good musicians, the space doesn't mean as much. So it's kind of when there's, you know, when everything comes together and you have great people, you know, behind the engineering and production, and you have great musicians and a great studio, you're really just ticking all the boxes and you kind of can't go wrong.
There's a railway hotel in every town around here. If you stick around long enough, they'll make you disappear.
If I Want In, right now that's out there as a standalone track. Is that part of an album to be?
Right. Yes. So that is the first single off my new album that's coming next year. So really excited. There'll be a few more singles before the album itself is out. And it's the record that we made all over the world, you know, just Abbey Road just being one of the places. But we're also in LA at East West Studios, and we also made a bunch of tracks in Nashville at Peter Frampton Studio Phoenix. So it was kind of just it came together so beautifully over about a 3-month period in the middle of this year over the American summer. So I'm so excited for people to hear it. It's definitely the best music I've ever made, and I'm so proud of the songwriting, and it's just going to be really special to finally get it out. I'm kind of like, I can't believe I have to wait till next year. This is crazy.
You know, it's funny. It's such a different business. You know, you think about, I say this, and it was at least 10 years ago that I remember interviewing Wayne Coyne from Flaming Lips. And he at the time was talking about how it used to be that the promotion of an album started the day it was released. And at that point, like 10 years ago, that he said, promotion of the album is done once it's out. All the work you do is in advance. And, you know, and now we're to a place where you're putting songs out months before the record finally happens. That's
absolutely
hard on your head to work through this, is, you know, sort of this record being kind of out and not. It's like sort of trickling into existence. Yes.
That trickling into existence is a really good way of putting it, to be honest. It is very, it's so strange because you make the record and you're so amped up to share it with people. And then you often like, okay, well, let's wait another year or 18 months till this thing actually comes out. So by the time it comes out, you've written a bunch of new songs, presumably. So you know, it's hard, but it's also really good in a way because it means that you can sort of milk it for all it's worth, and a lot of songs get their own standalone moments, and you can really focus on these songs and feel like they get their own sort of time in the spotlight, which is really nice. And I think also, you know, it's interesting the way the world has changed, because I'm currently reading a book about Frank Sinatra, and back in those days, obviously, you know, the cycles were so short, you would just be recording constantly and churning out new music constantly. And now cycles for musicians are so, so long. You know, you might have a 2 or 3 year album cycle. And so, you know, I think the world has certainly changed, but there are some good things about it as well.
You know, you think that one of those that will blow your mind is to think about when AC/DC with Bon Scott was hitting, that those records, those most important records, all came out like 6 months apart. There was a point at that time they were touring America a lot of the time with Cheap Trick. Cheap Trick released first album In Color and whatever the Heaven Tonight, all 6 months apart. People used to just work that fast. The idea was stay out, stay on the road, get off just long enough to make new music to sell. And AC/DC made such amazing music during that time and on that kind of time frame.
Wow. It's so hard to imagine, isn't it? Just the idea of like being on the road doing tours like that, and then also being sort of trying to sneak in time in the studio amidst that. And that was also before a lot of like on the road sort of touring technology, on the road recording technology was invented. So there's a lot, like, you know, these days you can take a little remote sort of recording studio on a tour bus, and at least you can get things done like that. But that was a long time ago. That's so crazy to think about the way the music industry has changed, isn't it?
Well, I'm thinking for you in Australia, it has to be sort of multiplied because you're making music that's going to come out in the future, and obviously, if you're working in London and working in Nashville, you're envisioning how is this record going to land in other countries, not just how is it going to land in Australia.
Absolutely,
Is that at this point a major part of how you think about certainly this next record?
For sure. That's a really good question. I definitely like to think about things like that, especially because I feel that America is actually my market a lot more than Australia is. As much as I love it here and have grown up here, I'm actually relocating to Nashville next year. So
oh, wow.
It's very much it's a really exciting time. I've been going to Nashville for sort of extended writing and recording trips for almost 10 years now. And I love it there. And I think something about my music really works in America. And so I'm looking forward to actually being on ground there and sort of making the most of that opportunity and being able to connect with people more than just, a 2 or 3 month trip can allow you to do. So yeah, it's interesting. I'm always thinking about that. And we have a team of people, we've got publicity in Australia and we've got publicity in America. But the publicity in America also sort of does rest of the world. So sometimes, we'll get blog write-ups from, people in Argentina or whatever. And it's always like, wow, I wonder what is connecting about my music to folks over there. And it's really wild to see.
Oh, that's amazing. That's got to be great. And I have to say, you telling me that makes a lot of things make sense, because one of the things I was thinking about listening to your music was that on one hand, you're talking about your influences, and many of them are rock and roll influences, but I also hear some contemporary country in there. And it's like, and that writing in Nashville puts the pieces together for me. So
totally. Yeah. That's so funny. Yeah, it's cool to hear what people hear, to find out what other people hear in it. There's definitely a lot of Sheryl Crow in my stuff. She's a huge influence on me. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And she has become kind of the unacknowledged, I don't know if you're not in country, maybe it's there it is, but out of country, you realize she's not recognized as kind of the blueprint for modern women in country. So
that's so true, isn't it? Because I think she's such she's a bit of she's a bit of a wild card, because she's country, but she's also really rock, and she's got this Tom Petty thing about her, but then she's, this beautiful sort of acoustic singer-songwriter as well. So I think it's got to do with her sort of genre bending style. And that's kind of the sort of artist that I've always wanted to be, is someone that can do a lot of different things and have it all just come under the banner of my brand and my style,
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. So by the time people hear this, you will also have a Christmas song, a new Christmas song in the
Yay.
World. We'll talk about the other ones in a minute, but you will have Not Christmas Here will be out.
Yes.
Tell us the story of Not Christmas Here.
So Not Christmas Here was written with Steve Pultz, who's an amazing singer-songwriter out of Nashville. He's originally Californian but lives in Nashville now. And love him so much. He's a real troubadour who's just been touring his entire life. And I met him in Australia last year at a festival. And so, we really hit it off and we were like, let's write a song when I'm in Nashville. So we wrote a couple of songs, actually. And Not Christmas Here was one of them. And it's really about the fact that I'm moving to Nashville. And Christmas has always been a time for me. I love Christmas. And I feel like the reason I love it so much is because it's a time for me to totally switch off. And because I normally work really hard. But over Christmas, I like to just kind of relax. And I go see my family out west of Sydney. See my family dog out there and drink white wine because it's very hot here at Christmas, and eat cold seafood and just completely switch off for a week or two. And the fact that I'm moving to Nashville is really scary for me in that way. I'm so excited about it, but I'm terrified of the idea of leaving my mum, who I'm really close with, and my dog. And the fact that Christmas is going to be so different in the Northern Hemisphere, the weather will be very different. So it's kind of a song about the fact that, what I'm going to miss about Australian Christmas and how scary it is to kind of be moving to the other side of the world and how it might not feel like Christmas for me for a while, because the Christmas I'm used to is very different.
Gentle people, start your engines. Let the countdown begin. so many shopping days left, but I really don't care. Pack my bags, the hustle and the bustle. Autumn leaves start to rustle. Back home, it's gonna be a scorching man.
In there, I heard a line, you wonder who'll make the gravy. Was that a reference to Paul Kelly's How to Make Gravy?
Of course, one of my favorite songs of all time. And I'm so glad that you know that, because I know that his music is not always hasn't always reached American audiences the way that it is so iconic in Australia.
And I was going to ask you to go ahead and tell people both what's the reference and tell people about Paul Kelly's How to Make Gravy.
Sure, sure. So the lyric is wondering who's going to make the gravy. And that is a reference to a Paul Kelly song called How to Make Gravy. The song is about it's written from the perspective of a man who is in prison over the Christmas period. And he's writing a letter to his brother to say, you know, he won't be home for Christmas, obviously, and sort of imagining what Christmas is going to be like without him there. And I think the reason the song is so incredibly special and one of my, not only my favorite Christmas song, but one of my favorite songs of all time, is that it really describes, it gives you the feeling of family and true love for family and this real, what it means to be human through the idea of absence. Like he's not there, and that's what makes it so powerful. I think Paul Kelly is just, he's basically Australia's Bob Dylan. That's how I like to explain him to people in other countries who might not be familiar with his music. He is just such an icon here. We all respect him as being, you know, one of the greatest songwriters that's ever come out of this country. And I've had the privilege of sort of chatting to him a few times, and he's just he's a very lovely, gentle, and introverted kind of genius of a guy. So, yeah, anyone who's not familiar with his music definitely has to get on top of it.
Hello, Dan. It's Joe here. I hope you're keeping well. It's the 21st of December. Now they're ringing the last bell. If I get good behavior, I'll be out of here by July.
You know, it's funny. It picks up one of the most basic notes of so many American, certainly, Christmas songs, in that song, that feeling of absence, of wanting to be somewhere you're not. I mean, that's at the core of certainly of White Christmas, of I'll Be Home for Christmas. And, you know, that it's clear, you know, you can change the location, you can change the language, but that sense of not being where you want to be on the holiday is clearly emotionally really powerful and has led to a lot of great Christmas songs.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that is the most powerful thing, because it is so human. The idea of missing somebody and being unable to be with them at a special time of year where family is meant to be together, and that heartbreak, he really captures it beautifully. And that song's always been a bit of a North Star to me as far as how to write a beautiful song. It's almost like a masterclass, you know?
Oh, that's great. Have you spent Christmas away from away from Australia before?
You know, I actually haven't. I've been away from home so many times, but it's never seemed to fall over the Christmas period, and that's probably just because it's so, there's so frequently everything shuts down over Christmas. I think, you know, it's one of those things where I get to be at home so often and just relaxing, and it's really nice. So I haven't actually done that before. So I'm looking forward to the first time that I get to, you know, I get to do that. It'll be scary, but it'll be really lovely at the same time.
So are there other Australian Christmas songs we ought to know about, other ones that are important?
I mean, I really think that how to make gravy is at the top of that list. Like, I think there's a lot of beautiful ones, but I think that of all of them, that one has always remained at the sort of pinnacle. So that's my number one recommendation for everybody.
So, but are there other significant Australian Christmas songs?
You know, I think that there are. Actually, there's a beautiful one by Tim Minchin. If you know, audiences are aware of Tim. He's the he's I think quite big in the UK as well. But there's a beautiful song called White Wine in December, and that's a gorgeous song by Tim Minchin. I feel like there are a bunch of them, but they're not as specifically Australian as those two. Like, right. They're the ones that come to mind that are like the most kind of Australian DNA is really in there.
I am hardly religious. I'd rather break bread with Dawkins than Desmond Tutu, to be honest. And yes, I have all of the usual objections to consumerism, to the commercialization of an ancient religion, to the westernization of a dead Palestinian press ganged into selling PlayStations and beer.
But I still really do. American Christmas songs make it to Australia or become part of an Australian Christmas?
Definitely. We get all of the great, you know, all-time ones. We get all of the Bing Crosby old stuff, and we get all of the Mariah Carey, and we get, you know, all of the newer stuff as well. So we do. We get a lot of you guys' Christmas stuff as well.
Has it changed over the years? Has there been more in recent time? I have a theory, which is why I ask.
You know, actually, I don't know. I feel like there might be more Christmas songs of recent years than there are now. I'm not really sure. I've never really noticed that. What's your theory?
Well, a number of years ago, I interviewed Tony Hadley from Spandau Ballet when he put out a Christmas album.
Oh,
and
wow.
This would be about 9 or 10 years ago. And at the time, he was telling me that not very much, American Christmas music made it to England. And I've interviewed people in the last few years in England and around the world, and there's a lot more penetration. It used to be that maybe a White Christmas and a handful of songs made it, but a lot didn't. And I've been wondering if it's an effect of streaming, and that now, yes, where you would have only heard it if the radio would have played it or if you physically had it. Now, streaming has made it possible to just simply grab Christmas playlists, and everything is now available. And so it now can be where you are as easily as it can be where I am. So
I think that's exactly what it is. Streaming is definitely, it's brought the whole world closer together in that way, in that we can all access music immediately from any part of the world, and all the playlisting brings it to us. And yeah, I think that's a really good theory.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I live in New Orleans, and there was a time where New Orleans was this kind of isolated playground. It's like, it was 3/4 of a day drive from almost anywhere. It's a flight and a connection from anywhere. And so it was kind of always by itself. And in the last 20 to 30 years, its music has become more like other people's music because the sound of music in other places is here now. And that the internet's made it so that the only place that's truly remote anymore is a place that doesn't have connectivity. If you're connected, you basically are, you know, you aren't remote anymore. And which is a really interesting thing to think through.
That's so true. I think that's really interesting, because I've always thought about it as a really interesting fact as far as people being more connected and what that means as being a really good thing. But I never thought about the fact that that would also mean that more remote areas, that had their sort of own identity that's so different and so unique, that would kind of dilute that a little bit. I've never thought about that from that perspective. So that's really interesting. I've actually never been to New Orleans and I would love to go. People keep telling me it's so beautiful. I've got to go.
It's pretty awesome. I'm not going anywhere. So,
willingly. We can grab a coffee.
Exactly. Not Christmas Here is not your first Christmas song. You've now got, is that your third Christmas song?
Yes, it is. Yeah, that's right.
So what made you decide that you should be writing Christmas songs?
You know, it's funny, like I love Christmas. As I said before, I'm a real big Christmas fan, but I don't love Christmas songs. I think most of the time, or at least I don't love the classic Christmas songs. You know, I'm not a big sort of jingle bells type person. Like I like sort of special Christmas songs that are a bit unique. And so that's why I decided to start writing my own. I think it was 2020, the first one came out. It's been a really fun journey because every year I've kind of tried to think of a new take on a Christmas song and sort of a new perspective to write a Christmas song from. And so the first one was called My Last Christmas With You. And that was a bit of a sort of a heartbreaking song about knowing that you and that your partner are needing to break up because you're not right for one another, but wanting to spend one more Christmas together so that the end of your relationship can be a positive thing that you can look back on as being a sweet time rather than ending with sadness and argument.
Buy a word from the 7-Eleven, mulled wine that only gets better, the more of it you drink. Hanging lights, you told me you loved me at every single Christmas party.
There's that song, and then, you know, there's also been this one that's coming out now is my fourth one, because there was another one called When Can I Touch You Again, which was during the pandemic, and that was really interesting because that was a song written in Relay. So we sent it to a bunch of different musicians. Someone put down Luke Davison, one of my drummers, he put down a great drum line. We sent it to my producer, Mike Bloom, who put down guitars. So it literally just went around and around until it was finished. And it was about, you know, being during the pandemic and there was social distancing happening and all that sort of stuff, the idea of not being able to be with someone, not being able to touch someone.
Let's stop there. I want to get into these. So let's not rush. Let's not just blow through them here. Because COVID was such an interesting time that I ended up, I had far more interviews than I've ever had on the show because simply so many people were available, you know, so many musicians.
Yes.
And I got the impression from a lot of musicians that they made Christmas records that year because they just wanted something to do. And
that is so true.
So tell me about your process, about the experience of making one. I mean, did you, after you did the first one, did you plan to do a, you know, make this your thing, or was it just a matter of like, I got to do something, I'm going nuts here?
Yeah, honestly, it was a little bit of both. We sort of, my manager Jeremy and I were discussing the fact that, you know, that we wanted to do a Christmas song, and then when we did the first one, we thought, oh, we should do this every year. You know, it's a bit of a challenge, you know, to come up with a new Christmas song every year and record it, because especially because Christmas always sneaks up on you, doesn't it? It's like you're in June and all of a sudden you're like, oh, I've got to start thinking about how, you know, writing, recording, putting this song together, you know, in summer, in American summer, I should say. So you know, it's always fun, but we decided it would be a good challenge and it would be a good thing to do to make a Christmas song every year. And they've all been a bit different. As far as the process goes, the very first one, My Last Christmas With You, that was made with Mike Bloom, who just made a bulk of my recent album. He's based out of LA, and he put this wonderful track together, which I then sang over remotely in Australia and sent back my vocals. So we, you know, we made a whole song without ever actually being in the same room, which was fun. But a lot of it was a coping mechanism. It was like, what can I do with my time to stop myself from going absolutely insane? So I think you're right. It's a bit of both.
So for that, for your COVID year project, for
When Can I Touch You Again?
When Can I Touch You Again? Yes, for that one.
Yes.
So you were never in the same room on that project. You did that entirely.
No.
Do you have a space in your house where you can record vocals?
Yeah, absolutely. So I, since then, have moved around a fair bit, but at that point I was. Because I was back from touring and I was, you know, off the road because of COVID, I was actually staying with my folks out in Western Sydney. And my dad, being a musician, has a big sort of an at-home studio that he's thrown together with different pieces of equipment. So I borrowed his studio for that one. But since then, I've moved to a lot of different places and I now have my own little remote setup. So I've just got a little interface and I've got a couple of mics and some sort of, you know, a MIDI keyboard, and I can just do stuff from my laptop now, which is very, very helpful on the road. But at that time it was really so strange to make a whole song never in the same room as anyone, you know, not even my manager, like just completely at distance with every musician and everybody adding their bits. It was really special. It was like, it was again, another way of keeping sane and having a creative project to focus your energy on so that you weren't just feeling this negative energy of what was happening in the world. And I understand it was different in America, as far as in Australia, we had government mandated lockdown. So we were, for a lot of this period, we were unable to actually go, you know, within a few kilometers of our house. So it was pretty hard, but, you know, that was just one of the many coping mechanisms that we all developed, I think, was working on music remotely.
Well, you know, and I'd have to imagine, I think about that time and how small gestures came to mean a lot. And I wonder if the process for you of recording and getting music from somebody and adding music to it took on an emotional component of, this is sort of as close as you could get to those people. And because it was at least being creative together, that it felt a little closer and a little more sort of emotionally rewarding than at a time when you really needed that kind of feeling.
Absolutely. That's so true. I'd have conversations with my manager, who is also just one of my best friends, and you know, we spend so much time together. And when, you know, when we all couldn't do the things we normally do that make us happy, it was a time where it felt like having, you know, a part of your heart taken out. You know, it just felt really lonely and isolating. And having music to work on, you know, because we not only worked on these Christmas songs, but also I put out a couple of EPs during the whole COVID period. And having something to work on, just something to put your energy into, something, a reason to get up every day, was really, really important to us. And Jeremy and I both sort of said that to each other. We were like, I don't know what I would have done without these projects. Like, we just needed something to keep us rooted in music, because I was also working a day job trying to make ends meet, and feeling like I'd locked music out of my life completely if not for these projects. So very lucky in that regard.
Yeah. So And your most recent one was it dumped for Christmas?
Oh, I got dumped for Christmas.
I got dumped for Christmas. So was this autobiographical? Yeah.
You know, hilariously, it sort of was and it sort of wasn't. I had had a year of very hilarious, like last year for me was just a year of hilarious romantic endeavors that went absolutely nowhere. Like I'd had the funniest year. Looking back on it, it was horrible at the time, but the funniest year of just so many awful situations with men. And so I just kind of wanted to make light of that and laugh at myself a bit and make this song about, you know, oh, what a lovely time of year it is at Christmas. And then it kicks into the chorus and it's like, you know, my baby's present for me was to dump me. So it's a bit of a silly, like it's so silly and fun. And I wrote it with Phil Barton, who's a fellow Australian who, expat who now lives in Nashville and makes a great living there as a wonderful songwriter. So it was really fun making that song because it was kind of such a tongue-in-cheek, you know, funny way of recapping a year of romantic failures.
What's the challenge when it comes to writing a Christmas song?
I think it's such a challenge because that the tendency of being too schmaltzy and a bit sort of corny. And I always wanted, you know, How to Make Gravy to be my blueprint. And so the idea of, you know, that is completely lacking in schmaltz and completely lacking in cheesiness. That's what I wanted for my Christmas songs. And so I think that's the hardest thing, is not making it too corny. Like, and I think if you don't want it to be corny, it has to be really authentically human, or it has to be kind of making fun of yourself, which was I Got Dumped for Christmas. That you have to find another angle that's not just this sort of schmaltzy, corny, you know, Christmas song. And that's what I don't like about classic Christmas songs most of the time. So that's the biggest challenge with those.
Thanks to Imogen Clark for the time and the talk. You can find her online in all the usual social media platforms and at imogenclark.com.au. You can find 12 Songs on Facebook and at 12songsofchristmas.com. If you like what you hear, leave a review with your podcast provider. That helps people find 12 Songs. As I said before, you can email me at alex@myspiltmilk for this year's Christmas mix, or you can find the 12 Songs of Christmas playlist at Spotify and Apple Music. Imogen's Not Christmas Here is included in this year's mix. We'll wrap with one more from Imogen Clark. From her upcoming album, this is Nonchalant. Talk to you next week.
You know I love an absolute. I wish I knew you loved denial use. Let me wait.